For a moment, she tried to free them, and then she relaxed. She even laughed a bit. "Oh, go ahead, silly, and don't look so solemn. I'm not blaming you." "You mustn't blame anyone. There is no blame necessary. We do what must be done. That mass duplicator is a classic case. I studied it in school. When you duplicate mass, you can duplicate persons, too. The problems that arise are very complicated. Isn't it up to the society to solve its own problems?" "It is, but we studied that society throughout time, and it doesn't solve the problem satisfactorily. Remember that its failure to do so affects not only itself, but all its descendant societies. In fact, there is no satisfactory solution to the mass duplicator problem. It's one of those things like atomic wars and dreamies that just can't be allowed. Developments are never satisfactory."
"What makes you so sure?"
"We have our computing machines, Noyes. Computerplexes far more accurate than any ever developed in any single reality. These compute the possible realities and grade the desirabilities of each over a summation of thousands and thousands of variables."
"Machines."
She said it with scorn. Harlan frowned, then relented hastily. "Now don't be like that. Naturally, you resent learning that life is not as solid as you thought. You and the world you lived in might have been only a probability shadow a year ago, but what's the difference? You have all your memories, whether they're of probability shadows or not, haven't you? You remember your childhood and your parents, don't you?"
"Of course."
"Then it's just as if you lived it, isn't it? Isn't it? I mean, whether you did or not."
"I don't know. I'll have to think about it. What if tomorrow it's a dream world again, or a shadow, or whatever you call it?"
"Then there would be a new reality, and a new you with new memories. It would be just as though nothing had happened except that the sum of human happiness would have been increased again."
"I don't find that satisfying somehow."
"Besides," said Harlan hastily, "nothing will happen to you now. There will be a new reality, but you're in eternity. You won't be changed."
"But you say it makes no difference,"
said Noyes gloomily.
"Why go to all the trouble?"
With sudden ardor, Harlan said, "Because I want you as you are. Exactly as you are. I don't want you changed, not in any way." He came within a hair of blurting out the truth, that without the advantage of the superstition about eternals and eternal life, she would never have inclined toward him. She said, looking about with a slight frown,
"Will I have to stay here forever then? It would be lonely."
"No, no, don't think of it," he said wildly, gripping her hand so tight that she winced. "I'll find out what you will be in the new reality of the 482nd, and you'll go back in disguise, so to speak. I'll take care of you. I'll apply for permission for formal liaison and see to it that you remain safely through future changes. I'm a technician and a good one, and I know about changes." He added grimly, "And I know a few other things as well," and stopped there. Noyes said,
"Is all this allowed? I mean, can you take people into eternity and keep them from changing? It doesn't sound right somehow from the things you've told me."
For a moment, Harlan felt shrunken and cold in the large emptiness of the thousands of centuries that surrounded him up when and down. For a moment, he felt cut off even from the eternity that was his only home and only faith, doubly cast out from time and eternity, and only the woman for whom he had forsaken it all left at his side. He said, and he meant it deeply, "No, it is a crime. It is a very great crime, and I am bitterly ashamed. But I would do it again if I had to, and any number of times if I had to."
"For me, Andrew? For me?"
He did not raise his eyes to hers.
"No, Noyes, for myself. I could not bear to lose you."
She said,
"And if we are caught?"
Harlan knew the answer to that. He knew the answer since that moment of insight in bed in the 482nd, with Noyes sleeping at his side. But even yet, he dared not think of the wild truth. He said,
"I am not afraid of anyone. I have ways of protecting myself. They don't imagine how much I know."
Chapter 9 Interlude. It was, looking back at it, an idyllic period that followed. 100 things took place in those physio weeks, and all confused itself inextricably in Harlan's memory, later, making the period seem to have lasted much longer than it did. The one idyllic thing about it was, of course, the hours he could spend with Noyes, and that cast a glow over everything else. Item 1. At the 482nd, he slowly packed his personal effects, his clothing and films, most of all his beloved and tenderly handled news magazine volumes out of the primitive. Anxiously, he supervised their return to his permanent station in the 575th. Finge was at his elbow as the last of it was lifted into the freight kettle by maintenance men. Finge said, choosing his words with unerring triteness, "Leaving us, I see." His smile was broad, but his lips were carefully held together so that only the barest trace of teeth showed. He kept his hands clasped behind his back, and his pudgy body teetered forward on the balls of his feet. Harlan did not look at his superior. He muttered a monotoned, "Yes, sir." Finge said, "I will report to Senior Computer Twistle concerning the entirely satisfactory manner in which you performed your observational duties in the 482nd. Harlan could not bring himself to utter even a sullen word of thanks. He remained silent. Finge went on, in a suddenly much lower voice, "I will not report, for the present, your recent attempt at violence against me." And although his smile remained, and his glance remained mild, there was a relish of cruel satisfaction about him. Harlan looked up sharply and said, "As you wish, computer." Item 2. He re-established himself at the 575th. He met Twistle almost at once. He found himself happy to see that little body, topped by that lined and gnome-like face. He was even happy to see the white cylinder nestling smokily between two stained fingers and being lifted rapidly toward Twistle's lips. Harlan said, "Computer." Twistle, emerging from his office, looked for a moment unseeingly and unrecognizingly at Harlan. His face was haggard, and his eyes squinted with weariness. He said, "Ah, Technician Harlan. You are done with your work on the 482nd?
"Yes, sir."
Twistle's comment was strange. He looked at his watch, which, like any watch in eternity, was geared to physio time, giving the day number as well as the time of day, and said, "On the nose, my boy, on the nose. Wonderful, wonderful." Harlan felt his heart give a small bound. When he had last seen Twistle, he would not have been able to make sense of that remark. Now he thought he did. Twistle was tired, or he would not have spoken so close to the core of things, perhaps. Or the computer might have felt the remark to be so cryptic as to feel safe despite its closeness to the core. Harlan said, speaking as casually as he could to avoid letting it seem that his remark had any conception at all with what Twistle had just said, "How's my cub?"
"Fine, fine," said Twistle, with only half his mind, apparently, on his words.
He took a quick puff at the shortening tube of tobacco, indulged in a quick nod of dismissal, and hurried off. Item 3. The cub. He seemed older. There seemed to be a greater feeling of maturity to him as he held out his hand and said, "Glad to see you back, Harlan." Or was it merely that, where earlier Harlan had been conscious of Cooper only as a pupil, he now seemed more than a cub? He now seemed a gigantic instrument in the hands of the Eternals. Naturally, he could not help but attain a new stature in Harlan's eyes. Harlan tried not to show that. They were in Harlan's own quarters, and the technician basked in the creamy porcelain surfaces about him, glad to be out of the ornate splash of the 482nd. Try as he might to associate the wild baroque of the 482nd with Noyes,
He only succeeded in associating it with Finge. With Noyes, he associated a pink, satiny twilight and, strangely, the bare austerity of the sections of the hidden centuries. He spoke hastily, almost as though he were anxious to hide his dangerous thoughts. "Well, Cooper, what have they been doing with you while I was away?" Cooper laughed, brushed his drooping mustache self-consciously with one finger, and said, "More math, always math." "Yes? Pretty advanced stuff by now, I guess."
"Pretty advanced."
"How's it coming?"
"So far it's bearable. It comes pretty easy, you know. I like it. But now they're really loading it on."
Harlan nodded and felt a certain satisfaction. He said, "Temporal field matrices and all that." But Cooper, his color a little high, turned toward the stacked volumes in the bookshelves and said,
"Let's get back to the primitives. I've got some questions."
"About what?"
"City life in the 23rd, Los Angeles especially."
"Why Los Angeles?"
"It's an interesting city, don't you think so?"
"It is, but let's hit it in the 21st then. It was at its peak in the 21st.
"Oh, let's try the 23rd.
Harlan said, "Well, why not?" His face was impassive, but if the impassiveness could have been peeled off, there would have been a grimness about him. His grand intuitional guess was more than a guess. Everything was checking neatly. Item 4. Research. Twofold research. For himself, first. Each day, with ferreting eyes, he went through the reports on Twissel's desk. The reports concerned the various reality changes being scheduled or suggested. Copies went to Twissel routinely, since he was a member of the All-When Council, and Harlan knew he would not miss one. He looked first for the coming change in the 482nd. Secondly, he looked for other changes, any other changes that might have a flaw, an imperfection, some deviation from maximum excellence that might be visible to his own trained and talented technician's eyes. In the strictest sense of the word, the reports were not for his study, but Twissel was rarely in his office these days, and no one else saw fit to interfere with Twissel's personal technician. That was one part of his research. The other took place in the 575th section branch of the library. For the first time, he ventured out of those portions of the library which, ordinarily, monopolized his attention. In the past, he had haunted the section on primitive history, very poor indeed, so that most of his references and source materials had to be derived from the far down when of the third millennium, as was only natural, of course. To an even greater extent, he had ransacked the shelves devoted to reality change, its theory, technique, and history, an excellent collection. Best in eternity outside the central branch itself, thanks to Twissel, of which he had made himself full master. Now he wandered curiously among the other film racks. For the first time, he observed, in the capital O sense, the racks devoted to the 575th itself, its geographies, which varied little from reality to reality, its histories, which varied more, and its sociologies, which varied still more. These were not the books or reports written about the century by observing and computing eternals, with those he was familiar, but by the timers themselves. There were the works of literature of the 575th, and these stirred memories of tremendous arguments he had heard of concerning the values of alternate changes. Would this masterpiece be altered or not? If so, how? How did past changes affect works of art? For that matter, could there ever be general agreement about art? Could it ever be reduced to quantitative terms amenable to mechanical evaluation by the computing machines? A computer named August Senor was Twissel's chief opponent in these matters. Harlan, stirred by Twissel's feverish denunciations of the man and his views, had read some of Senor's papers and found them startling. Senor asked publicly, and to Harlan, disconcertingly, whether a new reality might not contain a personality within itself analogous to that of a man who had been withdrawn into eternity in a previous reality. He analyzed then the possibility of an eternal meeting his analog in time, either with or without knowing it, and speculated on the results in each case. That came fairly close to one of eternity's most potent fears, and Harlan shivered and hastened uneasily through the discussion. And of course, he discussed at length the fate of literature and art in various types and classifications of reality changes. But Twissel would have none of the last.
"If the values of art can't be computed," he would shout at Harlan, "then what's the use of arguing about it?"
And Twissel's views, Harlan knew, were shared by the large majority of the All-When Council. Yet now, Harlan stood at the shelves devoted to the novels of Eric Linkalu, usually described as the outstanding writer of the 575th, and wondered. He counted 15 different complete works collections, each, undoubtedly, taken out of a different reality. Each was somewhat different, he was sure. One set was noticeably smaller than all the others, for instance. 100 sociologists, he imagined, must have written analyses of the differences between the sets in terms of the sociological background of each reality, and earned status thereby. Harlan passed on to the wing of the library which was devoted to the devices and instrumentation of the various 575ths. Many of these last, Harlan knew, had been eliminated in time and remained intact as a product of human ingenuity only in eternity. Man had to be protected from his own too flourishing technical mind. That, more than anything else. Not a physio year passed but that somewhere in time nuclear technology veered too close to the dangerous and had to be steered away. He returned to the library proper and to the shelves on mathematics and mathematical histories. His fingers skimmed across individual titles, and after some thought, he took half a dozen from the shelves and signed them out. Item 5. Noyes. That was the really important part of the interlude, and all the idyllic part. In his off hours when Cooper was gone, when he might ordinarily have been eating in solitude, reading in solitude, sleeping in solitude, waiting in solitude for the next day, he took to the kettles. With all his heart he was grateful for the technician's position in society. He was thankful, as he had never dreamed he could be, for the manner in which he was avoided. No one questioned his right to be in a kettle, nor cared whether he aimed it up when or down. No curious eyes followed him, no willing hands offered to help him, no chattering mouths discussed it with him. He could go where and when he pleased. Noyes said, "You've changed, Andrew. Heavens, you've changed." He looked at her and smiled.
"In what way, Noyes?"
"You're smiling, aren't you? That's one of the ways. Don't you ever look in a mirror and see yourself smiling?"
"I'm afraid to. I'd say, I can't be that happy. I'm sick. I'm delirious. I'm confined to an asylum, living in daydreams and unaware of it."
Noyes leaned close to pinch him. "Feel anything?"
He drew her head toward him, felt bathed in her soft, black hair.
When they separated, she said breathlessly, "You've changed there, too. You've become very good at it."
"I've got a good teacher," began Harlan, and stopped abruptly, fearing that would imply displeasure at the thought of the many who might have had the making of such a good teacher. But her laugh seemed untroubled by such a thought. They had eaten, and she looked silky smooth and warmly soft in the clothing he had brought her.
She followed his eyes and fingered the skirt gently, lifting it loose from its soft embrace of her thigh. She said, "I wish you wouldn't, Andrew. I really wish you wouldn't."
"There's no danger," he said carelessly.
There is danger. Now don't be foolish. I can get along with what's here until you make arrangements.
Why shouldn't you have your own clothes and doodads?
Because they're not worth your going to my house in time and being caught. And what if they make the change while you're there?
He evaded that uneasily. It won't catch me. Then brightening. Besides, my wrist generator keeps me in physio time so that a change can't affect me, you see?
Noyes sighed. I don't see. I don't think I'll ever understand it all.
There's nothing to it.
And Harlan explained and explained with great animation, and Noyes listened with sparkling eyes that never quite revealed whether she was entirely interested or amused, or, perhaps, a little of both. It was a great addition to Harlan's life. There was someone to talk to, someone with whom to discuss his life, his deeds, and thoughts. It was as though she were a portion of himself, but a portion sufficiently separate to require speech and communication rather than thought. She was a portion sufficiently separate to be able to answer unpredictably out of independent thought processes. Strange, Harlan thought, how one might observe a social phenomenon such as matrimony and yet miss so vital a truth about it. Could he have predicted in advance, for instance, that it would be the passionate interludes that he would later least often associate with the idol? She snuggled into the crook of his arm and said, "How is your mathematics coming along?"
Harlan said, "Want to look at a piece of it?"
"Don't tell me you carry it around with you."
"Why not? The kettle trip takes time, no use wasting it, you know."
He disengaged himself, took a small viewer from his pocket, inserted the film, and smiled fondly as she put it to her eyes. She returned the viewer to him with a shake of her head. "I never saw so many squiggles. I wish I could read your standard intertemporal."
"Actually," said Harlan, "most of the squiggles you mention aren't intertemporal, really. Just mathematical notation."
"You understand it, though, don't you?"
Harlan hated to do anything to disillusion the frank admiration in her eyes, but he was forced to say, "Not as much as I'd like to. Still, I have been picking up enough math to get what I want. I don't have to understand everything to be able to see a hole in a wall big enough to push a freight kettle through."
He tossed the viewer into the air, caught it with a flick of his hand, and put it on a small end table. Noyes's eyes followed it hungrily, and sudden insight flashed on Harlan. He said, "Father Time, you can't read intertemporal at that."
"No, of course not."
"Then the section library here is useless to you. I never thought of that. You ought to have your own films from the 482nd. She said quickly, "No, I don't want any."
He said, "You'll have them."
"Honestly, I don't want them. It's silly to risk."
"You'll have them," he said.
For the last time, he stood at the immaterial boundary separating eternity from Noyes's house in the 482nd. He had intended the time before to be the last time. The change was nearly upon them now, a fact he had not told Noyes out of the decent respect he would have had for anyone's feelings, let alone those of his love. Yet it wasn't a difficult decision to make, this one additional trip. Partly, it was bravado, to shine before Noyes, bring her the book films from out the lion's mouth. Partly, it was a hot desire, what was the primitive phrase, to singe the beard of the King of Spain, if he might refer to the smooth-cheeked Finge so. Then, too, he would have the chance, once again, of savoring the weirdly attractive atmosphere about a doomed house. He had felt it before, when entering it carefully during the period of grace allowed by the spatio-temporal charts. He had felt it as he wandered through its rooms, collecting clothing, small objets d'art, strange containers, and instruments from Noyes's vanity table. There was the somber silence of a doomed reality that was past merely the physical absence of noise. There was no way for Harlan to predict its analog in a new reality.
It might be a small suburban cottage or a tenement in a city street. It might be zero with untamed scrubland replacing the park-like terrain on which it now stood. It might, conceivably, be almost unchanged. And, Harlan touched on this thought gingerly, it might be inhabited by the analog of Noyes, or, of course, it might not. To Harlan, the house was already a ghost, a premature specter that had begun its hauntings before it had actually died. And because the house, as it was, meant a great deal to him, he found he resented its passing and mourned it. Once, only, in 5 trips had there been any sound to break the stillness during his prowlings. He was in the pantry then, thankful that the technology of that reality and century had made servants unfashionable and removed a problem. He had, he recalled, chosen among the cans of prepared foods, and was just deciding that he had enough for 1 trip, and that Noyes would be pleased indeed to intersperse the hearty but uncolorful basic diet provided in the empty section with some of her own dietary. He even laughed aloud to think that not long before he had thought her diet decadent. It was in the middle of the laugh that he heard a distinct clapping noise. He froze. The sound had come from somewhere behind him, and in the startled moment during which he had not moved, the lesser danger that it was a housebreaker occurred to him first, and the greater danger of its being an investigating eternal occurred second. It couldn't be a housebreaker. The entire period of the spatio-temporal chart, grace period and all, had been painstakingly cleared and chosen out of other similar periods of time because of the lack of complicating factors. On the other hand, he had introduced a micro-change, perhaps not so micro at that, by abstracting Noyes. Heart pounding, he forced himself to turn. It seemed to him that the door behind him had just closed, moving the last millimeter required to bring it flush with the wall. He repressed the impulse to open that door, to search the house. With Noyes's delicacies in tow, he returned to eternity and waited 2 full days for repercussions before venturing into the far up when. There were none. And eventually, he forgot the incident. But now, as he adjusted the controls to enter time this one last time, he thought of it again. Or perhaps it was the thought of the change nearly upon him now that preyed on him. Looking back on the moment later, he felt that it was one or the other that caused him to misadjust the controls. He could think of no other excuse. The misadjustment was not immediately apparent. It pinpointed the proper room, and Harlan stepped directly into Noyes's library. He had become enough of a decadent himself now to be not altogether repelled by the workmanship that went into the design of the film cases. The lettering of the titles blended in with the intricate filigree until they were attractive but nearly unreadable. It was a triumph of aesthetics over utility. Harlan took a few from the shelves at random and was surprised. The title of one was Social and Economic History of Our Times. Somehow, it was a side of Noyes to which he had given little thought. She was certainly not stupid, and yet, it never occurred to him that she might be interested in weighty things. He had the impulse to scan a bit of the social and economic history, but fought it down. He would find it in the section library of the 482nd, if he ever wanted it. Finge had undoubtedly rifled the libraries of this reality for eternity's records months earlier. He put that film to one side, ran through the rest, selected the fiction and some of what seemed light non-fiction. Those and 2 pocket viewers. He stowed them carefully into a knapsack. It was at that point that, once more, he heard a sound in the house. There was no mistake this time. It was not a short sound of indeterminate origin. It was a laugh, a man's laugh. He was not alone in the house. He was unaware that he had dropped the knapsack. For one dizzy second, he could think only that he was trapped.
Chapter 10. Trapped. All at once, it had seemed inevitable. It was the rawest dramatic irony. He had entered time one last time, tweaked Finge's nose one last time, brought the pitcher to the well one last time. It had to be then that he was caught. Was it Finge who laughed? Who else would track him down, lie in wait, stay a room away, and burst into mirth? Well then, was all lost? And because in that sickening moment he was sure all was lost, it did not occur to him to run again or to attempt flight into eternity once more. He would face Finge. He would kill him if necessary. Harlan stepped to the door from behind which the laugh had sounded, stepped to it with the soft, firm step of the premeditated murderer. He flicked loose the automatic door signal and opened it by hand. 2 inches. 3. It moved without sound. The man in the next room had his back turned. The figure seemed too tall to be Finge, and that fact penetrated Harlan's simmering mind and kept him from advancing further. Then, as though the paralysis that seemed to hold both men in rigor was slowly lifting, the other turned, inch by inch. Harlan never witnessed the completion of that turn. The other's profile had not yet come into view when Harlan, holding back a sudden gust of terror with a last fragment of moral strength, flung himself back out the door. Its mechanism, not Harlan, closed it soundlessly. Harlan fell back blindly. He could breathe only by struggling violently with the atmosphere, fighting air in and pushing it out, while his heart beat madly as though in an effort to escape his body. Finge, Twistle, all the council together could not have disconcerted him so much. It was the fear of nothing physical that had unmanned him. Rather, it was an almost instinctive loathing for the nature of the accident that had befallen him. He gathered the stack of book films to himself in a formless lump and managed, after 2 futile tries, to re-establish the door to eternity. He stepped through, his legs operating mechanically. Somehow he made his way to the 575th, and then to personal quarters. His technicianhood, newly valued, newly appreciated, saved him once again. The few Eternals he met turned automatically to one side and looked steadfastly over his head as they did so. That was fortunate, for he lacked any ability to smooth his face out of the death's head grimace he felt he was wearing, or any power to put the blood back into it. But they didn't look, and he thanked time and eternity and whatever blind thing wove destiny for that. He had not truly recognized the other man in Noyes's house by his appearance, yet he knew his identity with a dreadful certainty. The first time Harlan had heard a noise in the house, he, Harlan, had been laughing, and the sound that interrupted his laugh was of something weighty dropping in the next room. The second time, someone had laughed in the next room, and he, Harlan, had dropped a knapsack of book films. The first time, he, Harlan, had turned and caught sight of a door closing. The second time, he, Harlan, closed a door as a stranger turned. He had met himself. In the same time and nearly in the same place, he and his earlier self, by several physio days, had nearly stood face to face. He had misadjusted the controls, set it for an instant in time which he had already used, and he, Harlan, had seen him, Harlan. He had gone about his work with the shadow of horror upon him for days thereafter. He cursed himself for a coward, but that did not help. Indeed,
From that moment, matters took a downward trend. He could put his finger on the great divide. The key moment was the instant in which he had adjusted the door controls for his entry into the 482nd for one last time, and somehow had adjusted it wrongly. Since then, things went badly, badly. The reality change in the 482nd went through during that period of despondency and accentuated it. In the past 2 weeks, he had picked up 3 proposed reality changes which contained minor flaws, and now he chose among them, yet could do nothing to move himself to action. He chose reality change 2456 to 2781 V5 for a number of reasons. Of the 3, it was farthest up when, the most distant. The error was minute, but was significant in terms of human life. It needed then only a quick trip to the 2456th to find out the nature of Noyes's analog in the new reality by use of a little blackmailing pressure. But the unmanning of his recent experience betrayed him. It seemed to him no longer a simple thing, this gentle application of threatened exposure. And once he found the nature of Noyes's analog, what then? Put Noyes in her place as charwoman, seamstress, laborer, or whatever? Certainly. But what then was to be done with the analog herself, with any husband the analog might have, family, children? He had thought of none of this earlier. He had avoided the thought. Sufficient unto the day. But now he could think of nothing else. So he lay, skulking in his room, hating himself, when Twistle called him, his tired voice questioning and a little puzzled.
"Harlan, are you ill? Cooper tells me you've skipped several discussion periods."
Harlan tried to smooth the trouble out of his face. "No, Computer Twistle. I'm a little tired."
"Well, that's forgivable at any rate, boy."
And then, the smile on his face came about as close as it ever did to vanishing entirely.
"Have you heard that the 482nd has been changed?"
"Yes," said Harlan shortly.
"Finge called me," said Twistle, "and asked that you be told that the change was entirely successful."
Harlan shrugged, then grew aware of Twistle's eyes staring out of the communiplate, and hard upon him. He grew uneasy and said, "Yes, computer?"
"Nothing," said Twistle,
and perhaps it was the cloak of age weighing down upon his shoulders, but his voice was unaccountably sad.
"I thought you were about to speak."
"No," said Harlan. "I had nothing to say."
"Well, then, I'll see you tomorrow at opening in the computing room, boy. I have a great deal to say."
"Yes, sir," said Harlan. He stared for long minutes at the plate after it went dark. That had almost sounded like a threat. Finge had called Twistle, had he? What had he said that Twistle did not report? But an outside threat was what he needed. Battling a sickness of the spirit was like standing in a quicksand and beating it with a stick. Battling Finge was another thing altogether. Harlan had remembered the weapon at his disposal, and for the first time in days felt a fraction of self-confidence return. It was as though a door had closed, and another had opened. Harlan grew as feverishly active as previously he had been catatonic. He traveled to the 2456th and bludgeoned sociologist Voy to his own exact will. He did it perfectly. He got the information he sought. And more than he sought, much more. Confidence is rewarded, apparently. There was a home-wen proverb that went, "Grip the nettle firmly, and it will become a stick with which to beat your enemy." In short, Noyes had no analog in the new reality. No analog at all. She could take her position in the new society in the most inconspicuous and convenient manner possible, or she could stay in eternity. There could be no reason to deny him liaison except for the highly theoretical fact that he had broken the law, and he knew very well how to counter that argument. So he went racing upwind to tell Noyes the great news, to bathe in undreamed-of success after a few days horrible with apparent failure. And at this moment, the kettle came to a halt. It did not slow, it simply halted. If the motion had been one along any of the three dimensions of space, a halt that sudden would have smashed the kettle, brought its metal to a dull red heat, turned Harlan into a thing of broken bone and wet, crushed flesh. As it was, it merely doubled him with nausea and cracked him with inner pain. When he could see, he fumbled to the temperometer and stared at it with fuzzy vision. It read 100,000. Somehow that frightened him. It was too round a number. He turned feverishly to the controls. What had gone wrong? That frightened him too, for he could see nothing wrong. Nothing had tripped the drive lever. It remained firmly geared into the upwind drive. There was no short circuit. All the indicator dials were in the black safety range. There was no power failure. The tiny needle that marked the steady consumption of megcoulombs of power calmly insisted that power was being consumed at the usual rate. What, then, had stopped the kettle? Slowly and with considerable reluctance, Harlan touched the drive lever, curled his hand about it. He pushed it to neutral, and the needle on the power gauge declined to zero. He twisted the drive lever back in the other direction. Up went the power gauge again, and this time the temperometer flicked down when along the line of centuries. Down when, 99,983. 99,972, 99,959. Again, Harlan shifted the lever. Up when again, slowly, very slowly. Then, 99,985, 99,993, 99,997, 99,998, 99,999, 100,000. Smash. Nothing passed 100,000. The power of Nova Sol was silently being consumed at an incredible rate to no purpose. He went down when again, farther. He roared up when. Smash. His teeth were clenched, his lips drawn back, his breath rasping. He felt like a prisoner hurling himself bloodily against the bars of a prison. When he stopped, a dozen smashes later, the kettle rested firmly at 100,000. Thus far, and no farther. He would change kettles, but there was not much hope in that thought. In the empty silence of the 100,000th century, Andrew Harlan stepped out of one kettle and chose another kettle shaft at random. A minute later, with the drive lever in his hand, he stared at the marking of 100,000 and knew that here, too, he could not pass. He raged. Now, at this time, when things so unexpectedly had broken in his favor, to come to so sudden a disaster. The curse of that moment of misjudgment in entering the 482nd was still on him. Savagely, he spun the lever down when, pressing it hard at maximum and keeping it there. At least in one way he was free now, free to do anything he wanted. With Noyes cut off behind a barrier and out of his reach, what more could they do to him? What more had he to fear? He carried himself to the 575th and sprang from the kettle with a reckless disregard for his surroundings that he had never felt before. He made his way to the section library, speaking to no one, regarding no one. He took what he wanted without glancing about to see if he were observed. What did he care? Back to the kettle, and down when again. He knew exactly what he would do. He looked at the large clock as he passed, measuring off standard physio time, numbering the days and marking off the 3 co-equal work shifts to the physio day. Finge would be at his private quarters now, and that was so much the better. Harlan felt as though he were running a temperature when he arrived at the 482nd. His mouth was dry and cottony. His chest hurt, but he felt the hard shape of the weapon under his shirt as he held it firmly against his side with one elbow, and that was the only sensation that counted. Assistant Computer Hob Finge looked up at Harlan, and the surprise in his eyes slowly gave way to concern. Harlan watched him silently for a while, letting the concern grow and waiting for it to change to fear. He circled slowly, getting between Finge and the communiplate. Finge was partly undressed, bare to the waist. His chest was sparsely haired, his breasts puffy and almost womanish. His tubby abdomen lapped over his waistband. "He looks undignified," thought Harlan with satisfaction, "undignified and unsavory. So much the better." He put his right hand inside his shirt and closed it firmly on the grip of his weapon. Harlan said, "No one saw me, Finge, so don't look toward the door. No one's coming here. You've got to realize, Finge, that you're dealing with a technician. Do you know what that means?" His voice was hollow. He felt angry that fear wasn't entering Finge's eyes, only concern. Finge even reached for his shirt and, without a word, began to put it on. Harlan went on, "Do you know the privilege of being a technician, Finge? You've never been one, so you can't appreciate it. It means no one watches where you go or what you do. They all look the other way and work so hard at not seeing you that they really succeed at it. I could, for instance, go to the section library, Finge, and help myself to any curious thing while the librarian busily concerns himself with his records and sees nothing. I can walk down the residential corridors of the 482nd, and anyone passing turns out of my way and will swear later on he saw no one. It's that automatic. So you see, I can do what I want to do, go where I want to go. I can walk into the private apartments of the assistant computer of a section and force him to tell the truth at weapon point, and there'll be no one to stop me." Finge spoke for the first time. "What are you holding?" "A weapon," said Harlan, and brought it out. "Do you recognize it?" Its muzzle flared slightly and ended in a smooth metallic bulge. "If you kill me," began Finge. "I won't kill you," said Harlan. "At a recent meeting you had a blaster. This is not a blaster. It is an invention of one of the past realities of the 575th. Perhaps you are not acquainted with it. It was bred out of reality. Too nasty. It can kill, but at low power it activates the pain centers of the nerve system and paralyzes as well. It is called, or was called, a neuronic whip. It works. This one is fully charged. I tested it on a finger." He held up his left hand with its stiffened little finger. "It was very unpleasant." Finge stirred restlessly.
"What is all this about, for time's sake?"
"There is some sort of a block across the kettle shafts at the 100,000th. I want it removed."
"A block? Across the shafts?"
"Let's not work away at being surprised. Yesterday you spoke to Twistle. Today there is the block. I want to know what you said to Twistle. I want to know what's been done and what will be done. By time, computer, if you don't tell me, I'll use the whip. Try me, if you doubt my word."
"Now listen."
Finge's words slurred a bit, and the first edge of fear made its appearance, and also a kind of desperate anger.
"If you want the truth, it's this. We know about you and Noyes."
Harlan's eyes flickered.
"What about myself and Noyes?"
Finge said,
"Did you think you were getting away with anything?"
The computer kept his eyes fixed on the neuronic whip, and his forehead was beginning to glisten.
"By time, with the emotion you showed after your period of observation, with what you did during the period of observation, did you think we wouldn't observe you? I would deserve to be broken as computer if I had missed that. We know you brought Noyes into eternity. We knew it from the first. You wanted the truth? There it is.
At that moment, Harlan despised his own stupidity.
You knew? Yes. We knew you had brought her to the Hidden Centuries. We knew every time you entered the 482nd to supply her with appropriate luxuries, playing the fool with your Eternal's oath, completely forgotten.
Then why didn't you stop me? Harlan was tasting the very dregs of his own humiliation.
Do you still want the truth?
Finge flashed back, and seemed to gain courage in proportion as Harlan sank into frustration.
Go on. Then let me tell you that I didn't consider you a proper Eternal from the start. A flashy observer, perhaps, and a technician who went through the motions, but no Eternal. When I brought you here on this last job, it was to prove as much to Twistle, who values you for some obscure reason. I wasn't just testing the society in the person of the girl, Noyes. I was testing you, too, and you failed as I thought you would fail. Now put away that weapon, that whip, whatever it is, and get out of here.
And you came to my personal quarters once, said Harlan breathlessly, working hard to keep his dignity and feeling it slip from him, as though his mind and spirit were as stiff and unfeeling as the whiplashed little finger on his left hand, to goad me into doing what I did.
Yes, of course. If you want the phrase exactly, I tempted you. I told you the exact truth, that you could keep Noyes only in the then-present reality. You chose to act, not as an Eternal, but as a sniveler. I expected you to.
I would do it again now, said Harlan gruffly, and since it's all known, you can see I have nothing to lose. He thrust his whip outward toward Finge's plump waistline and spoke through pale lips and clenched teeth. What has happened to Noyes?
I have no idea.
Don't tell me that. What has happened to Noyes?
I tell you I don't know.
Harlan's fist tightened on the whip. His voice was low.
Your leg first. This will hurt.
For time's sake, listen, wait!
All right. What has happened to her?
No, listen. So far, it's just a breach of discipline. Reality wasn't affected. I made checks on that. Loss of rating is all you'll get. If you kill me, though, or hurt me with intent to kill, you've attacked a superior. There's the death penalty for that.
Harlan smiled at the futility of the threat. In the face of what had already happened, death would offer a way out that in finality and simplicity had no equal. Finge obviously misunderstood the reasons for the smile. He said hurriedly,
"Don't think there's no death penalty in eternity, because you've never come across one. We know of them, we computers. What's more, executions have taken place, too. It's simple. In any reality, there are members of fatal accidents in which bodies are not recovered. Rockets explode in mid-air, airliners sink in mid-ocean, or crash to powder in mountains. A murderer can be put on one of those vessels minutes or seconds before the fatal results. Is this worth that to you?"
Harlan stirred and said,
"If you're stalling for rescue, it won't work. Let me tell you this. I'm not afraid of punishment. Furthermore, I intend to have Noyes. I want her now. She does not exist in the current reality. She has no analog. There is no reason why we cannot establish formal liaison."
"It is against regulations for a technician."
"We will let the All-Wen Council decide," said Harlan, and his pride broke through at last. "I am not afraid of an adverse decision either, any more than I am afraid of killing you. I am no ordinary technician."
"Because you are Twistle's technician."
And there was a strange look on Finge's round, sweating face that might have been hatred, or triumph, or part of each. Harlan said,
"The reason's much more important than that. And now?"
With grim determination, he touched finger to the weapon's activator. Finge screamed,
"Then go to the Council! The All-Wen Council! They know! If you are that important,"
he ended, gasping. For a moment, Harlan's finger hovered irresolutely.
"What? Do you think I would take unilateral action in a case like this?
I reported this whole incident to the Council, timing it with the reality change. Here are the duplicates.
Hold on, don't move.
But Finge disregarded that order. With a speed as from the spur of a possessing fiend, Finge was at his files. The finger of one hand located the code combination of the record he wanted. The fingers of the other punched it into the file. A silvery tongue of tape slithered out of the desk, its pattern of dots just visible to the naked eye.
"Do you want it sounded?" asked Finge, and without waiting, threaded it into the sounder.
Harlan listened, frozen. It was clear enough. Finge had reported in full. He had detailed every motion of Harlan's in the kettle shafts. He hadn't missed one that Harlan could remember, up to the point of making the report. Finge shouted when the report was done.
"Now then, go to the Council! I've put no block in time. I wouldn't know how, and don't think they're unconcerned about the matter. You said I spoke to Twistle yesterday, you're right. But I didn't call him, he called me, so go, ask Twistle. Tell them what an important technician you are, and if you want to shoot me first, shoot, and to time with you."
Harlan could not miss the actual exultation in the computer's voice. At that moment, he obviously felt enough the victor to believe that even a neuronic whipping would leave him on the profit side of the ledger. Why? Was the breaking of Harlan so dear to his heart? Was his jealousy over Noyes so all-consuming a passion? Harlan did scarcely more than formulate the questions in his mind, and then the whole matter, Finge and all, seemed suddenly meaningless to him. He pocketed his weapon, whirled out the door and toward the nearest kettle shaft. It was the Council then, or Twistle at the very least. He was afraid of none of them, nor of all put together. With each passing day of the last unbelievable month, he had grown more convinced of his own indispensability. The Council, even the All-Wen Council itself, would have no choice but to come to terms when it was a choice of bartering one girl for the existence of all of eternity.
Chapter 11. Full Circle. It was with a dull surprise that technician Andrew Harlan, on bursting into the 575th, found himself in the night shift. The passing of the physio hours had gone unnoticed during his wild streaks along the kettle shafts. He stared hollowly at the dimmed corridors, the occasional evidence of the thinned-out night force at work. But in the continued grip of his rage, Harlan did not pause long to watch uselessly. He turned toward personal quarters. He would find Twistle's room on computer level, as he had found Finge's, and he had as little fear of being noticed or stopped. The neuronic whip was still hard against his elbow as he stopped before Twistle's door, the nameplate upon it advertising the fact in clear, inlaid lettering. Harlan activated the door signal brashly on the buzzer level. He shorted the contact with a damp palm and let the sound become continuous. He could hear it dimly. A step sounded lightly behind him, and he ignored it in the sure knowledge that the man, whoever he was, would ignore him. Oh, rose-red technician's patch. But the sound of steps halted, and a voice said, "Technician Harlan?" Harlan whirled. It was a junior computer, relatively new to the section. Harlan raged inwardly. This was not quite the 482nd. Here he was not merely a technician, he was Twistle's technician, and the younger computers, in their anxiety to ingratiate themselves with the great Twistle, would extend a minimum civility to his technician. The computer said, "Do you wish to see Senior Computer Twistle?" Harlan fidgeted and said, "Yes, sir." The fool! What did he think anyone would be standing signaling at a man's door for, to catch a kettle? "I'm afraid you can't," said the computer.
This is important enough to wake him, said Harlan.
Maybe so, said the other. But he's out when? He's not in the 575th.
Exactly when is he then? Asked Harlan, impatiently. The computer's glance became a supercilious stare.
I wouldn't know,
Harlan said, but I have an important appointment first thing in the morning.
You have, said the computer, and Harlan was at a loss to account for his obvious amusement at the thought.
The computer went on, even smiling now.
You're a little early, aren't you?
But I must see him.
I'm sure he'll be here in the morning.
The smile broadened. But the computer passed by Harlan, carefully avoiding any contact, even of garments. Harlan's fists clenched and unclenched. He stared helplessly after the computer, and then, simply because there was nothing else to do, he walked slowly, and without full consciousness of his surroundings, back to his own room. Harlan slept fitfully. He told himself he needed sleep. He tried to relax by main force and, of course, failed. His sleep period was a succession of futile thought. First of all, there was Noyes. They would not dare harm her, he thought feverishly. They could not send her back to time without first calculating the effect on reality, and that would take days, probably weeks. As an alternative, they might do to her what Finge had threatened for him, place her in the path of an untraceable accident. He did not take that into serious consideration. There was no necessity for drastic action such as that. They would not risk Harlan's displeasure by doing it. In the quiet of a darkened sleeping room, and in that phase of half-sleep where things often grew queerly disproportionate in thought, Harlan found nothing grotesque in his sure opinion that the All-Wen Council would not dare risk a technician's displeasure. Of course, there were uses to which a woman in captivity might be put. A beautiful woman from a hedonistic reality. Resolutely, Harlan put the thought away as often as it returned. It was at once more likely and more unthinkable than death, and he would have none of it. He thought of Twissel. The old man was out of the 575th. Where was he during hours when he should have been asleep? An old man needs his sleep. Harlan was sure of the answer. There were council consultations going on. About Harlan. About Noyes. About what to do with an indispensable technician one dared not touch. Harlan's lips drew back. If Finge reported Harlan's assault of that evening, it would not affect their considerations in the least. His crimes could scarcely be worsened by it. His indispensability would certainly not be lessened. And Harlan was by no means certain that Finge would report him. To admit having been forced to cringe before a technician would put an assistant computer in a ridiculous light, and Finge might not choose to do so. Harlan thought of technicians as a group which, of late, he had done rarely. His own somewhat anomalous position as Twissel's man and as half an educator had kept him too far apart from other technicians. But technicians lacked solidarity anyway. Why should that be? Did he have to go through the 575th and the 482nd, rarely seeing or speaking to another technician? Did they have to avoid even one another? Did they have to act as though they accepted the status into which the superstition of others forced them? In his mind, he had already forced the capitulation of the council as far as Noyes was concerned, and now he was making further demands. The technicians were to be allowed an organization of their own, regular meetings, more friendship, better treatment from the others. His final thought of himself was as a heroic social revolutionary, with Noyes at his side when he sank, finally, into a dreamless sleep. The door signal awoke him. It whispered at him with hoarse impatience. He collected his thoughts to the point of being able to look at the small clock beside his bed and groaned inwardly. Father Time! After all that, he had overslept. He managed to reach the proper button from bed, and the view square, high on the door, grew transparent. He did not recognize the face, but it carried authority, whoever it was. He opened the door, and the man, wearing the orange patch of administration, stepped in.
Technician Andrew Harlan?
Yes, Administrator. You have business with me?
The administrator seemed in no wise discommoded at the sharp belligerence of the question. He said,
You have an appointment with Senior Computer Twistle?
Well?
I am here to inform you that you are late.
Harlan stared at him.
What's this all about? You're not from the 575th, are you?
The 222nd is my station, said the other frigidly.
Assistant Administrator Arbut Lem.
I'm in charge of the arrangements, and I'm trying to avoid undue excitement by bypassing official notification over the communiplate.
What arrangements? What excitement? What's it all about? Listen, I've had conferences with Twistle before. He's my superior. There's no excitement involved.
A look of surprise passed momentarily over the studious lack of expression the administrator had so far kept on his face.
You haven't been informed?
About what?
Why? That a subcommittee of the All-Wen Council is holding session here at the 575th. This place, I am told, has been alive with the news for hours.
And they want to see me?
As soon as he asked that, Harlan thought, Of course they want to see me. What else could the session be about but me? And he understood the amusement of the junior computer last night outside Twistle's room. The computer knew of the projected committee meeting, and it amused him to think that a technician could possibly expect to see Twistle at a time like that. Very amusing, thought Harlan bitterly. The administrator said,
I have my orders. I know nothing more.
Then, still surprised,
You've heard nothing of this?
Technicians, said Harlan sarcastically, lead sheltered lives. Five besides Twistle. Senior computers all. None less than 35 years and eternal. 6 weeks earlier, Harlan would have been overwhelmed by the honor of sitting at lunch with such a group, tongue-tied by the combination of responsibility and power they represented. They would have seemed twice life-size to him. But now, they were antagonists of his, were still judges.
He had no time to be impressed. He had to plan his strategy.
They might not know that he was aware they had Noyes. They could not know, unless Finge told them of his last meeting with Harlan. In the clear light of day, however, he was more than ever convinced that Finge was not the man to broadcast publicly the fact that he had been browbeaten and insulted by a technician. It seemed advisable, then, for Harlan to nurse this possible advantage for the time being, to let them make the first move, say the first sentence that would join actual combat. They seemed in no hurry. They stared at him, placidly, over an abstemious lunch, as though he were an interesting specimen spread-eagled against a plane of force by mild repulsors. In desperation, Harlan stared back. He knew all of them by reputation, and by trimensional reproduction in the physio-monthly orientation films. The films coordinated developments throughout the various sections of eternity, and were required viewing for all eternals with rating from observer up. August Senor, the bald one, not even eyebrows or eyelashes, of course attracted Harlan most. First, because the odd appearance of those dark, staring eyes against bare eyelids and forehead was remarkably greater in person than it had ever seemed in trimension. Second, because of his knowledge of past collisions of view between Senor and Twistle. Finally, because Senor did not confine himself to watching Harlan. He shot questions at him in a sharp voice. For the most part, his questions were unanswerable, such as,
How did you first come to be interested in primitive times, young man? Do you find the study rewarding, young man?
Finally, he seemed to settle himself in his seat. He pushed his plate casually onto the disposal chute and clasped his thick fingers lightly before him.
There was no hair on the back of the hands, Harlan noticed.
Senor said, "There is something I have always wanted to know. Perhaps you can help me."
Harlan thought, "All right now, this is it." Aloud he said, "If I can, sir."
"Some of us here in eternity. I won't say all or even enough."
And he cast a quick glance at Twistle's tired face, while the others drew closer to listen.
"But some, at any rate, are interested in the philosophy of time. Perhaps you know what I mean."
"The paradoxes of time travel, sir?"
"Well, if you want to put it melodramatically, yes. But that's not all, of course. There is the question of the true nature of reality, the question of the conservation of mass energy during reality change, and so on. Now we in eternity are influenced in our consideration of such things by knowing the facts of time travel. Your creatures of the primitive era, however, knew nothing of time travel. What were their views on the matter?"
Twistle's whisper carried the length of the table.
"Cobwebs."
But Senor ignored that. He said,
"Would you answer my question, technician?"
Harlan said, "The primitives gave virtually no thought to time travel, computer."
"Did not consider it possible, eh?"
"I believe that's right."
"Did not even speculate?"
"Well, as to that," said Harlan uncertainly, "I believe there were speculations of sorts in some types of escape literature. I am not well acquainted with these, but I believe a recurrent theme was that of the man who returned in time to kill his own grandfather as a child." Senor seemed delighted.
"Wonderful, wonderful. After all, that is at least an expression of the basic paradox of time travel, if we assume an indeviant reality, eh? Now, your primitives, I'll venture to state, never assumed anything but an indeviant reality, am I right?"